They keep telling us the death of print media is drifting ever closer. But as Monocle celebrates 10 proud years of pages, that thought couldn't be further from our minds. We'll examine the myth and magic of making magazines today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up later, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco jumps on the line with Marie-Pierre Lanalong, editor-in-chief of French weekly M, le magazine du Monde.
What is a little bit difficult for us is to speak about Le Front National, because, you know, even if we speak about hard news, it's a glamorous magazine. It's a glossy magazine with a very, very beautiful layout. And I don't want Le Front National to be glamorous.
But first, it's been a week of birthday cake here at Midori House as Monocle celebrates 10 years in print. Our anniversary special is out on newsstands right now, and next week we'll be welcoming some of the brightest minds in the print world to our very own Media Summit. Details are on our website, but if you can't make it to London, you can always tune into next week's special hour-long programme where we'll be bringing you the best from the summit. Now, of course, Monocle magazine wouldn't be what it is today if it weren't for the parade of talents that put it together. From Tyler Brulé, our editor-in-chief, to Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell. I caught up with the latter too, just outside our studios here in Marylebone, where we were admiring our wall featuring all of Monocle's 10 years of eye-catching magazine covers. So here we are in front of the, I don't know what to call it, wall of fame or wall of infamy, maybe. It's every single cover of Monocle from way back in March 2007 right up to 101. And I'm also stood here admiringly gazing at these beautiful things with Andrew Tuck, the editor, and Richard Spence-Powell, the creative director. Rich, when you look at all these, do you just think, wow, that's a lot of hard work? What's the first thing? Before we talk about specific favourites, it's an impressive body of work, no?
Well, yeah, of course, I've done myself so myself. I don't know. I think it's a good resource. I'm often out here in production week looking back at what we've done, looking back at what things, which covers worked. I am always referencing it for colour, which is, you know, when I can use yellow again, basically. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, it doesn't feel like 10 years. You know, you do an issue, then you get on with the next one. That's the thing. You're always so busy preparing for the next one that you don't really look back. So, but yeah, it's a nice thing, I think, for guests that come into the office. It's the first thing they see is, here's our output.
And Andrew, presumably from your point of view, you just think of the production week for every single one of these and how you sort of aged a little bit more each time, or do you actually feel a sense of pride? Is it a bit like looking back at is it like an artist looking back at all his canvases? How do you feel when you look up?
Both me and for Rich, this wall is also a wall of mystery, because what's fascinating is you make a cover and you know you've created a cover that is something you really love, and you're very confident it'd be going out in the newsstand. And then maybe the sales don't quite come through as you anticipated that month. Other months you have a cover which you think, okay, we've made some compromises here. This isn't going to be the greatest cover we've ever done. And then the sales figures come back in and they're monumental. And so the bit that you never quite understand is it the cover? Is it the month? Is it the weather? Is it the political environment? So we did a couple of covers during the Brexit vote, one of which was stupendous, really surprised us. And another one which took a bit of a hit because I think people were a bit depressed post the vote. So all those things are out there in the ether. Strangely, we have found that a train sells very well. Now, I don't think we have any train spotter readers, but me and Rich talk about that because, you know, we know from, you know, tradition says a good cover often has a face, often eyes connecting with you, often somebody kind of looking you in the eye. And oddly, a car or a train with its headlights feels a bit like a face. So if there is a connection in that way, but me and Rich have always been mystified at how many train spotters we have.
So, Rich, what about a couple of... I mean, can you pick favourites? I know people say that's like choosing favourite children, but there's so many to choose from. Are there some where you just think, whether it was design, whether it's photography, whether it's because it was a big seller, or whether you were vindicated on chancing your arm a bit, are there any particular ones that are favourites of yours?
Well, in terms of vindicated on taking a chance, the issue 100 was a backup cover, and as sales are up 35%, and... I wrote the cover lines for that. Anyway, just saying. But certainly a favourite cover, a recent favourite cover, is this Playmobil cover. And I think the reasons I like it was just that was just a brilliant day in the office. I got to shoot with a favourite photographer, muck around with kids' toys. I got to fill up the world's smallest pitcher of beer and shoot it, and then put it on the cover, and no one said, no, you can't do that. It was just great, a great day. Really made me very satisfied and pleased with my day's work. And it sold a ton as well. So it was just an all-round winner. I loved it.
Andrew, what about you? Is it a question of kind of going back, I don't know, to those covers from, you know, 2007? I mean, regular listeners and readers and subscribers will remember the sort of, you know, Defence Forces from issue one. Or is it, I don't know, is it more of a left-field choice for you? Or do you also find it rather hard to pick favourites?
There's half a dozen covers on here that stick in my mind for very clear reasons. One of them, which is the first quality of life survey. For a very simple reason, you know, we had been trying to explain to a new world of readers what we were trying to do and trying to connect with people. And that summer, that double issue came out with the first quality of life survey. And it was the first time I was really confident that we knew what to do with the cover. And it was, you know, all the covers before that are amazing. They're a little bit experimental. They're a little bit stark. That was the first time I think we'd really connected in a consumer way. And that was, I think, in the office, there was Yeah, we were always happy and confident, but there was a bit of a mood change deep down that we knew we were on to something really good. I love the Brazilian cover in the Foreign Ministry. It's an extraordinary sweeping staircase. It's a piece of Niemeyer. And I love that story because I got to go to Brasilia, a place I wanted to go. And again, I think that it stripped backness and it worked very well as a cover. And in the animal world, yeah, I must also say that I do like the Sylvanian families were great. And it was also a tough day in the office because I had to interview the Sylvanian family animals who were starting their own sausage stand. And I think there's a few rude jokes on that cover as well.
I was going to say, some of your puns, the stuff of legend, and they feature prominently. Rich, what about as we look forward? Obviously, we've got the 10th anniversary special, 101. It's on newsstands now, so people will have noticed, I don't know, a pretty significant change, a redesign, the masthead is different. There's quite a lot of evolution. Do you think would you be standing here in 10 years' time and it will have evolved further? I don't know. What can we expect? Or is it not sensible to think that far ahead?
Whether I'll be in 10 years, I don't know. Whether the design will be the same, I don't know. I just know on issue one, we designed something that was built to last. We tried to make something classic that wouldn't need to be redesigned. And after a decade, we have redesigned and we've not changed tack. It's just a bit of streamlining, you know. It's just a bit like, I don't know, it's a BMW 3 Series. Then the next one comes out, it's still a BMW 3 Series, but it's a little bit sleeker. And I think that's what we've done. We've just done a little bit of housekeeping. Who knows how long we need to keep that going, certainly for as long as I think we should, but yeah, maybe in after 20 years we go again, you know, we relook at it. But I think the intention is that not to be schizophrenic, you know, be confident and build and keep building the brand, and so that's what I think we'll keep doing, and hopefully the readers like it, hopefully we keep evolving enough that we surprise them each month, and keep getting dogs on the cover.
Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck and our creative director Richard Spencer-Powell talking covers with me a little earlier. This is The Stack, and as promised, we'll have more on our 10-year anniversary later. But first, we head to France for a look at one of the nation's weekly news titles. M, Le Magazine du Monde, is distributed every week with Le Monde, Le Journal de Référence across France. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the magazine's editor-in-chief, Marie-Pierre Lanelong, about the latest issue and the difficulty covering the far-right political group Front National.
I'm Marie-Pierre Lanelong, and I'm the editor-in-chief of M, Le Magazine du Monde, which is the weekly supplement of Le Monde.
And Marie, I know you've been very closely involved with the launch of the magazine back in 2011. Can you tell us a bit more about this? It's a fairly recent magazine as well.
Yeah, actually, Le Monde published a weekly magazine for 10 years, but this version of Le Magazine, M Le Magazine du Monde, has been launched five years ago. It was September 23rd of 2011, and I worked on the concept by myself of the magazine and launched it in September, 5 years ago. The idea was to mix art news and lifestyle and to give as many importance to text and to pictures, to use top journalist as well as top photographer. As we say in French, le fond is as important as la forme. When we launched the magazine 5 years ago, we tried to explain that we wanted every week to edit a mix of T Magazine and the New York Times Magazine. And if I speak of the New York Times, it's because Le Monde and the New York Times are quite the same kind of daily paper.
You have excellent French journalists working at the magazine. You also have an improved fashion pages as well. Tell us a bit more about the names. I mean, some of the writers at your magazine.
Yeah, I must say that we are very lucky because as we work with Le Monde, as we are the supplement of Le Monde, we are very lucky because we work probably with the best French journalists, some names that you don't know in England, but Ariane Chemin, Raphaël Baquet and Florence Aubenas, to name a few, who are very big stars of journalism in France. And we decided to have the equivalent in terms of stylist. That's why we recently appointed Suzanne Collère as fashion editor. She formerly was the fashion director of Vogue Paris. She is the new fashion director of M. And also in the early 90s, she founded the magazine Self Service, which is probably one of the most influential and inspirational niche magazine of this period.
I'm a big fan of Self Service magazine. Really, really good choice, Marie. Let's talk about the upcoming issue. I mean, it's on the newsstands since, on Friday in France. What's the cover story?
The next issue will be launched on Friday afternoon because Le Monde is a Friday daily paper. On the cover, we have a very impressive story on a Tsigan painter which happened to be sent to death camps during World War II by the Nazi. She was in Auschwitz. And this woman began to paint end of the 90s. She was probably 60 years old, in her 60s, and she painted a lot of painting, a lot of things very dark about her experience as a child in the camps, and some very light paintings as well, with flowers inspired by her native culture of Tsigan. And it's very, very long story and very impressive, and this woman was not at all known by the art scene, and she has been discovered very recently, and it's more or less the same story as Vivian Maier, you know, this photographer, and suddenly you discover one painting and two painting, and you discover a major, major artist, actually.
It's fascinating, Marie, and also it's interesting, your magazine, you kind of try to have some hard news stories as well, of course, but, you know, as you mentioned, you know, fashion is always quite present, and I believe there'll be an upcoming story by Mario Sorrenti, the photographer.
So next Friday we have this impressive story, but the Friday after we are going to have our special fashion issue with a big story by photographer Mario Sorrenti, who is very well known, and a profile on Marie-Amélie Sauvé, another super stylist, who launched her own magazine last week, Mastermind, for Marie-Amélie Sauvé. And that's funny because you can't imagine so different subject, Marie-Amélie Sauvé and this Tsigan painter from Austria. So that's what we love to do. I mean, to mix different kind of subject and to be able to speak about politics as well as fashion, arts as well as international politics. And with the story of Marie-Amélie Sauvé, we hope to be able to explain to our readers that the fashion scene is as interesting, as vanitous, as egotic as politics, and politics is the major concern in France at the moment because we are supposed to elect a new president in 2 months. And the idea that we can do stories on fashion and on politics and try to make it as interesting for our readers, it's really the project of M.
Finally, Marie, you know, you did mention the elections. Are you preparing some sort of special coverage in your upcoming issues about this election, which, you know, everybody's talking about, even here in England as well?
We actually, since January, I think we have more or less a political feature every week, and sometimes two or three. And everything changes all the time, so there are a lot of things to write on. What is a little bit difficult for us is to speak about Le Front National, because, you know, even if we speak about our news, it's a glamorous magazine. It's a glossy magazine with a very, very beautiful layout. And I don't want Le Front National to be glamorous. So that's the only thing that it is a bit difficult for us to treat. But otherwise, as I explained to you, we can write and publish a lot of range of stories and of pictures.
Marie-Pierre Lanelong, editor-in-chief of M, Le Magazine du Monde, speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco earlier. This is The Stack on Monocle 24. Stay tuned.
Monocle is celebrating 10 years of keeping an eye and an ear on the world. But where would we be without our readers, our listeners and our contributors? Here's one of our friends from right here on The Stack, the founder of Mag Culture, Jeremy Leslie.
I remember when Monocle first launched, there was a lot of cynicism around it and people weren't sure about it at all. But for me, the best thing that's happened is A, that it's reached 10 years, and B, it's the amount of support that the magazine and the team at Monocle, both in print and on the radio, give to print and the world of independent publishing that's so alive at the moment.
Christoph Armand is the editor of Zeit magazine. He told us about a time he found himself in one of our favorite cities, Tokyo.
The first time in my life I went to Tokyo, I was sitting in a small restaurant called The Beard, and I talked to the chef, who told me that he was trained at Japanese in California. And we had a great time, and the food was amazing, and it was a really small place with only 6 or 7 tables. And then I thought about the fact that I first heard about the restaurant and read about it in Monocle magazine. And then I thought, we all live in a Monocle world.
And another member of Monocle's extended family, Mark Valley, publisher of Elephant magazine. He recalled the day he received the very first issue of Monocle in his bookshop.
When Monocle came up, I still used to run Magma, which is a chain of bookshops. And so my first memory of it is seeing it come in as a huge pile of magazines, which I thought there was no way I could sell. I thought, no, there's no way something called Monocle can sell. And it very quickly established itself almost as a classic, as its own identity. And for anyone who is a publisher, I think the overwhelming feeling when you look at Monocle is one, admiration, two, jealousy, because you think like, wow, this is a magazine that is doing everything a modern magazine should do.
Thanks to all our readers and listeners, and here's to another 10 years.
Thank you very much indeed, Fernando. This is The Stack on Monocle 24, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. And as we've been hearing, Monocle celebrating 10 years in print this week. For more on how we've navigated the at times treacherous waters of the publishing world, we'll hear from our editor, Andrew Tuck, and creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, once again.
Well, this magazine had been sitting in Tyler's brain for, I think, since he was a kid in a way. He wanted to always come back to the notion of what a news magazine was. He had been inspired by many European magazines, the likes of Stern. And he'd always felt that there was a place for an English language news magazine that did something a bit more substantial, a little bit more photojournalism driven than, say, Time or Newsweek. And that was the starting point. I've known Tyler many, many years. And in 2006, we had a conversation which led to me saying, yes, I'll come and join you. And I think pretty wise decision, current colleagues included. So 2006, I came on board. And by then he was, of course, having discussions already with Rich, who had worked with him for many years. So the challenge was, how do you, even then in a market where people were being cautious about what the future of print was, how do you bring something out that's defiantly print-based, that's positive about paper, that believes in ink on page, and create something that's going to be shipped all around the world and engage with audiences in lots of different places? And the idea, I think, was that you don't need to do anything extraordinary new. In a way, what had gone wrong with many of the titles that were failing was they'd forgotten the principles of what made a good magazine. So it was a tactile experience. It was that you saw places around the world that maybe you would never go to. So there was a kind of an old school National Geographic element. It should reveal the world to you. And that it should adhere to some of the old principles of journalism, like no freebies, that you should be revealing about your who you were and what you were doing, and that you should really believe in putting journalists out there on the ground. So if there was a challenge, it was, you know, kind of blowing away all the dust that had gathered around journalism and the media industry and finding out what the core principles were that made you come into the industry in the first place and why you believed that telling stories in an eloquent and visual way was still a very powerful thing to do on a piece of paper.
I mean, Rich, listening to Andrew now, it's a really, in a way, it's kind of quite a simple message and a simple set of principles. But I guess if you're tasked then with designing that, is that a simple process? How did you start? Because there were lots of considerations. I mean, Andrew alluded to it there, not making different editions for different markets. So you had to find things, I guess, that were sort of universal. I don't know, was it a daunting design process or could you not wait to get started?
I couldn't wait to get started. It wasn't daunting because it was such a blank canvas. You kind of, it was complete freedom and it was such an enticing project. You knew that it was going to be just fun to design and fun to work on. It came together quicker than I imagined, and I think probably quicker than Tyler imagined. But I put that down to not, you know, focus groups and hours of research. It was just, it's been talked about between us for a few years, and there was lots of things out there that we didn't like. And so we just kind of knew the things that we didn't want to do. And just listening to Andrew there, it was a very simple premise in a way. We wanted to do something quite old-fashioned, but in a modern way. And the two principal typefaces that we've chosen very early on were Plantin, which is an old serif typeface designed particularly for displaying news, and then Helvetica, which is sort of ubiquitous and universal and modern and clean. And there's something old and there's something new in there. And that kind of is a bit of a metaphor for how the design came about. Tara and I took ourselves to the Zurich office kind of before it all started, and we had like a sort of day and a half session just working through layouts. And we kind of came up with the principal layouts, which were taken then to potential investors and advertisers. And I would say 70% of those layouts made it into issue one, the grid and the colour choices, all of those things. And it was quite quick. And I think it's because we knew what we wanted to do. And so once you've got that, you kind of got a clear understanding, it kind of cuts out half of the sort of redesigning and options on page. You just go straight for what you think is the best. And that's sort of how it came together.
And no bad thing. Andrew, it's interesting. You talked about that quite a sort of clarity of message, I guess, that you were trying to communicate. Rich talks about the clarity of the design language. Did you realise then that this would be something which would endure and would grow and would, you know, attain this quite sort of iconic status? I mean, were the clues there compared, I don't know, with maybe other projects that you'd worked on in the past?
Yeah, let's not get too carried away by the clarity. We certainly made some mistakes along the way. We, you know, we commissioned stories that when they came in, we were like, oh my God, what were we thinking? This is not us. This is not on brand. There are things we adapted and changed along the way. And, you know, when I look back at those early magazines, it's very exciting. It feels a much more independent magazine world than we are now. We were thinking out some things on page. But because the core values were there, we knew that the things we were going to argue about, it felt pretty right from the beginning. But it's scary. You know, you're a group of people sitting in an office and you talked about this thing, you've commissioned stories and you kind of feel it's right, but in the end that journey is only successful if it finds the right newsstand, it gets into the right hands. And all that was, you know, there were some moments in that first year when you think, God, we really have to fight, we have to get out there and tell people about this, we need to change the way the newsstand's done, we have to go and see advertisers who don't have a global spend, we need to explain to them how they put that in place. We did a lot of very rudimentary things to make it a success. I often look back and I think that the reason, in a way, that we found our voice and we took off is because of the global crash. Now, that year was an awful year for the world and it did lots of good things to our brand. We were already talking about, from day one, I look back and there's a story in that very, very first issue about a company called Russell Moccasin, which was an American company, one of the few left still making shoes in America, had a great market, was exporting globally.
a globalized local company still believing in made in America. Now, just you unpack that story 10 years later, you know, if you look at Mr. Trump, you know, he's got that part right, you, about keeping some manufacturing in your country, but how you become global. So those stories, in a way, it was a story about a shoe company, but we found our voice, and we found our voice in 2008, because as the world went to, you know, went to a bad place, I won't use the words I was going to, into a bad place, you know, we were there saying, be positive, be engaged, think about how you use craft, think about how you use industry. And all those stories, they all came good.
That was Monocle's Andrew Tuck and Richard Spencer Powell. And that is it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producers Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and to our editors Claire Aban and Toby Hammond. Comments or queries are welcome as always. You can reach Fernando on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next Saturday. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for tuning in.